This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Domestic violence caseworkers see patterns. They say they see the things reported in the Sarah Meller murder case all the time.
The survivors or the victims still care about their offender. That is a very normal dynamic.
For instance, Meller did not leave her husband in spite of abuse. GLT's Charlie Schlenker talks with Sheena Ajabang of Countering Domestic Violence. The effort to establish a police citizen review board has created a community debate. You'll hear some of those comments from the last Bloomington Council meeting, as the council could vote to establish the board tonight. And Dawes is headed to the Castle Theater. Find out why they are worth the price of admission during an edition of What's on Your Turntable. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's July 24th, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The Bloomington City Council could vote tonight to establish a public safety citizens relation board. The issue has been debated for months, including public comment at the last City Council meeting. Here's some of that comment.
The police complaint investigation process is flawed. It's not about where do you go and get a piece of paper. It's about what happens when you submit the piece of paper and the police investigate themselves. People don't have trust in that.
In 1997, Bloomington Normal was nationally hailed as a model community for not in our town. In 2017, can't we again be hailed as a model city in addressing systemic racism?
I feel the police have this great opportunity to help our community be together so we can help break up the divide of the hate and the racism. We can start at a local level.
But here's the thing. In the nitty-gritty world of us versus them, the bullies can be on all sides. And the bullies think they are the good guys, only protecting themselves, their friends and family, their ideas, their loop.
You've heard the data, you've heard testimony. And there are some of you that still want to call this a perception issue. I know those who have had negative interactions with the police and have not filed complaints because they don't trust the police and they don't trust the complaint process.
I have witnessed my family be referred to as wetbacks and spics and be racially profiled, humiliated, and denied privileges that others are given freely. I am one of those people who have not called the police at times when I needed help. I am one of those people who feels terror during a traffic stop, who says to myself, this won't happen to me, but then wonders if Philando Castile or Sandra Bland thought the exact same thing.
I have students who don't understand why their parents are hurt and crying after being stopped by the police, but they have to comfort them. I have a friend who stopped driving altogether in Bloomington because they were being constantly stopped and harassed by police officers. Our community, especially folks of color, are hurting.
I come from a town and from parents who told me that when there was trouble, run to the police. The police will protect you. The police are good people, and you need to trust the police. I have friends and colleagues who tell their children something very different, and often, because of their lived experience, present interactions with the police as potentially dangerous and urge their children to do nothing that might give some message to the police that they pose a danger. I find that sickening. I find that sad that my lived reality is so different from that of so many of my friends.
There is an obvious disproportionality in the enforcement that is received by people of color in this community. And no matter how much you want to deny that, the problem is there. In fact, it's been studied, it's been researched. These aren't just people's stories. Now, throughout the last presentation, I heard from the chief that there are different organizations that could just help people through the complaint process. Every organization that he mentioned are organizations that are saying that this process isn't good enough, that we need a CRB.
From my own personal experience, it is hard for us as Black people to not be afraid of them. I do not want my children to have to live in fear of those who have taken an oath to protect and serve us. Chief Hefner met my daughter at the last meeting, and he gave her some reasonably sound advice. Rather than saying, police are your friends, trust the police, he said, you should not judge people until you get to know them, not even the police. And that is what I feel this community review board can provide for us.
The chief compared his department to a business. You can choose which business you go to, and if you don't like the service, you get to complain. Many of us don't have a choice about which community we live in.
I know that you didn't create racism, but make no mistake, it is absolutely your responsibility to do something about it. So let's start to bridge this divide by giving those who are most directly affected the power to help shape what policing looks like in this community. Know that I believe in your capacity to do the right thing with the power that you hold in your hands. I believe that you're loving people. Just don't forget that justice is what love looks like in public.
You heard Laura Dick, Elizabeth Kuba, Nancy Marciniak, Colleen Lucky, Cinnamon Porter, Gene Howard, Louis Gosland, Jen Carrillo, Jennifer Johnson, and Kaya Jai. These comments were produced by GLT's Charlie Schlenker. The Bloomington City Council could vote tonight to establish a Public Safety Citizens Relations Board. The meeting starts at 7 p.m. You're listening to Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping individuals and families create solid plans for the future through a combination of investment options and life insurance. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Coming up, a conversation about the patterns seen by domestic violence caseworkers, patterns that mirror those in the Sarah Meller murder case. Charlie Schlenker has that interview ahead during Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. In spite of a state budget passage, some school districts are questioning whether they can keep going for long once the school year begins this fall. That's the subject of the Illinois Politics Roundtable, moderated by IPR's Sean Crawford. Matt Dietrich of the Better Government Association and Ken Redfield, professor emeritus at the University of Illinois at Springfield, join IPR Statehouse reporter Brian Mackey, who starts the ball rolling by explaining why this is even an issue.
Illinois has had a thing that it's called the formula, right? It's the way that the state sends money to local school districts across the state. And that formula has been in place pretty much unchanged for almost about 20 years now. And people on both sides of the aisle have agreed that that formula is outdated. It's not fair. It doesn't equitably distribute money across the state. So both sides have pretty much agreed on that a new version of this formula is needed. There was a gubernatorial commission. They negotiated it. And when Democrats and a few Republicans finally passed a budget earlier this summer, they put that new formula as a requirement in the budget. The problem is they haven't actually passed the new formula into law. So as it stands right now, money cannot be distributed. State money cannot go to schools until some version of this new funding formula is put into law. And that's basically where we stand. The governor does not like the version that the Democrats are pushing, which would give some extra money to Chicago for its pensions. The governor is talking about if the Democrats send him that bill, without getting too much into the weeds here, that he would veto it. But so that's where we are.
And Matt, this is not necessarily such a complaint about giving the local school districts more money. It seems to be Republicans and Democrats have agreed that some of these districts need to be brought up a little bit, but this has to do, or at least it's being made out to be, an issue of Chicago versus downstate.
Right. And what the governor and a lot of Republicans have said is that this is a bailout of Chicago public schools, which is another way of saying it is overly generous. And this is an interesting point, and this is where the political backdrop of this cannot be avoided. If you go back to November, what happened in November was the General Assembly had passed a bill that was going to provide $215 million to Chicago Public Schools to be used for its pension system. Now, what happened in November was and there had been an agreement that had been in place since I think the summer before that Governor Rauner would sign this bill into law if the General Assembly passed a pension reform bill that the governor and Senate President John Cullerton had agreed on. What happened in November was President Cullerton made a public statement where he said, well, there was no deal for us to, you know, the governor needs to sign this bill to help CPS, but there wasn't an exchange. It wasn't a deal that we had made that was written in stone. I think the governor must have heard that because almost in real time, the veto came out right then. And for me, the problem that this creates when you look at SB 1 is that that bill, that $215 million, was not viewed as a bailout back in November. Had they passed pension reform, Rauner apparently would have been fine with signing it. Now, all of a sudden, when it's that $215 million has been restored in SB 1, now it's viewed as a bailout. So it wouldn't be a bailout if we had this pension reform in place now, which, by the way, I suspect we will see that at some point in the future. President Cullerton has been very explicit that we will bring that back when the timing is right, not in an election year. So to me, when you talk about this being a bailout, I see it as changing and ever, you know, the word bailout, it seems like the definition changes depending on the circumstances.
Kent, is this I guess what is going on here with the governor? He's changed, I guess, his tone on it, as Matt was mentioning. So is there a reason behind that?
Well, I mean, certainly the governor, having lost the budget in terms of, you know, what happened with the override, then, you know, everything gets played to the prism of, you know, how is this going to look in 2018? What kind of leverage can I use to make me a winner and the Democrats losers in terms of, you know, whatever the issue happens to be? And so, you know, both sides are saying, wow, you're holding the children hostage and putting the children at risk. And this is something that probably should have happened 2.5 years ago in terms of resolving the original budget stalemate. Is the pressure point that would have really gotten us off the dime initially would have been schools not opening in the fall of 2015. But, you know, we took that off the table, you know, for a whole bunch of reasons and did the same thing in 2016. So, you know, we're back to another pressure point. I mean, there's certainly policy in this. You know, you go back to the 1995 law that changed the Chicago schools and tried to deal with Chicago pensions, which they'd always picked up their own pensions, but they'd also had a dedicated property tax for that. And the new law took that away, but it gave the city a lot of control over the budget. The state was supposed to be giving them money to, you know, make up for the fact that they weren't getting pension money the way that other school districts were. You know, the state reneged on its promises. The city made a whole, and the school board made a whole bunch of stupid decisions. And so, you know, we've got the pensions are a mess. There's no question about that. But it's a very long history there. And this is about holding everybody harmless, and then how do we distribute the new money? But part of the fight of holding somebody harmless is, what is Chicago's fair share? What are they currently getting? It's pretty easy for another school district because we know, you know, we're treating them all the same. And so there's certainly policy in here, but it is a political fight. It's about advantage for 2018. And you know, we want to get kids back to school, but we'd like to look good and make the other side look bad in the process.
Yeah, I think that's a great point to emphasize that, you know, Chicago does not get the same pension treatment for its teachers that every other school district in the state does. The state picks up that cost, the employer cost of teacher pensions everywhere but Chicago. And so that is something that the district up there says puts them at a disadvantage. But there are other ways that the funding is different for Chicago. Schools, they get a big block grant instead of some of the individual funding items that go for other school districts. And the idea was that was just supposed to kind of, I think as Charlie has said on our program in the past, kind of streamline the funding for that. But you're right, Ken, too, when you say this is a political fight and it's about political advantage. We've seen the governor consistently oppose a lot of different things that would help Chicago financially because he has said that he doesn't think Mayor Rahm Emanuel is pushing Democrats in Springfield hard enough to go along with his agenda items, which include things like workers' compensation and limiting the power of public employee unions, things like that. Just earlier this summer, he vetoed a bill that would that actually became law, despite his veto, over 911 fees, and it would allow an increase in cell phone fees as more people have gotten rid of landlines. The phone use has shifted to cell phones, and we're trying to enhance 911 systems so you can text emergency instead of just calling and get your location more easily when you do that. So he had vetoed that bill. Chicago would have had a cell phone fee increase because it seems he didn't want Chicago to be able to raise that tax. And we've certainly seen Chicago raise taxes quite a bit in the last few years.
If this was Facebook, we'd say it's complicated, I guess. It's the status between the legislature and the governor. Matt, one thing that the governor has been very strong on this week, message-wise, has been going around saying how these other school districts are going to lose money under this plan. They would gain money if you took that Chicago pension payment out of there. Does that put, especially downstate and maybe even suburban Democrats, in a bit of a bind here?
Well, this is where it gets difficult because you didn't have complete. SB 1 passed the House with the minimum 60 votes. You did have one Republican in the House, was the lone Republican in the entire General Assembly. That's Michael McAuliffe. He's the only Republican in the House whose district is in Chicago. So this is very tenuous. And this is – I'm not trying to skirt your question, Sean, but what we're seeing now is this is a game of chicken. And the Senate has not sent the bill to the governor. As we heard at the outset of the program, it's held on to it to create more pressure because the later he gets a hold of that bill, the less time there's going to be between when schools have to have their money and when either they can work on either overriding the veto or changing the bill so the governor will sign it or, you know, approving or not approving his amendatory veto. What you're hearing from the suburban reps and senators is, you know, they get a lot of pressure because they see this ultimately as less state money coming into their districts. Even though this does hold everybody harmless for now, it kind of ramps it over the years. It's gonna smooth out. One other point that I think we need to bring up in the political background on this is that, and Brian, you and I sat through committee hearings back in, I believe it was January, that the Governor's Commission on Education Funding released a big report that, and the conclusion of that report was we need to go to what is called an evidence-based model where we look at each individual school district. What challenges do they face? You know, low income, English as a second language, how many disabled students there that you need to determine a per pupil funding level based on all of these things, not just one flat rate throughout the state. But what happened was, and there have been many commissions and reports on this issue over the years. The Governor's Commission came out with its report very early this year, but then did not push a specific bill from it. And I sat through committee hearings where I know that Andy Menar, who's a Democrat senator from downstate, and he's been a big issue on changing this for years, where he over and over asked Rauner's Education Secretary Beth Purvis, where is your bill? What will the governor sign? We need you to be You know, you need to forward us a bill that we can work on because we have to know what the governor will sign and what he won't sign. Beth Purvis's position and the administration's position is, hey, we leave that up to the legislature. That's why I think you ended up with these two competing bills. And I do think this is another example where the administration has been kind of ham-fisted in how it goes about, you know, also – this is one that Beth Purvis said the governor likes 90% of SB 1. Well, you like 90% of it. In politics, that's usually a victory.
Matt Dietrich is a writer for the Better Government Association. Joining him on the Politics Roundtable were IPR's Sean Crawford, Kent Redfield, a professor emeritus at the University of Illinois at Springfield, and IPR Statehouse reporter Brian Mackey. You're listening to Sound Ideas.
Coming up, find out why Dawes might be the price, right for the price of admission. The band is headed to the Castle Theater, and an edition of What's on Your Turntable is headed your way in a few minutes during Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Domestic violence advocates say they heard similarities in the Sarah Meller murder case and with the people they help. Meller was sentenced to 8 years in prison for killing her husband, Mark, after he tried to restrain her at a campground near Carlock. Mark Meller had grabbed Sarah Meller. He had threatened her. He had punched walls so hard he left holes that she later patched. Sheena Ajibang is the director of the Countering Domestic Violence Program and Neville House Shelter. GLT's Charlie Schlenker talks with Ajibang about the dynamics of domestic violence and what kind of environment that can create.
I think that it's important to emphasize that domestic violence, it's just not about physical abuse to a person. And from the descriptions, a lot of it is verbal abuse, emotional abuse, and also the dynamic of either toxic environment or just an unhealthy environment, and also emphasizing the fact that an individual hitting a wall or destroying property is a form of physical coercion or message to an individual that the next time that could be you as a human being. Usually when we talk to survivors, we walk them through the continuum of violence. It just doesn't happen from someone hitting. It takes a lot. It takes the verbal. It takes the belittling. It takes the people being ashamed of what's going on. It takes name-calling and yelling, and it progresses and escalates. We pay attention to that and usually educate and provide support for survivors or victims who are going through that when they describe some of those incidents to us.
In a relationship in which a partner is having to cope with a volatile other partner, as Sarah Meller was, what are the signs of stress that typically start to show in a person?
It would depend on an individual. It shows very differently in different people. Usually common signs of just being anxious, withdrawing from people, canceling appointments, canceling interactions with loved ones and friends, isolation.
Does it affect, over the long term, a person's ability to be resilient?
As the stress grows in an unhealthy relationship or an abusive relationship, without the right intervention and without the right support, whether it's family, friends, or a domestic violence program where you can have some counseling, you can have some talking to someone on the hotline to process that, I think that sometimes it's that difficult period when you feel like you don't have a way out. You feel like there are no other options. And we've had some clients who would say that it's either me or him, or it's either, and we have that opportunity, at least when we have someone on the hotline, to be able to provide some services and support to them. So, yeah, that's a possibility.
What do you tell people on the hotline about processing it? What do they need to hear to allow them to get a handle on their stress and to deal with their environment?
We do a lot of listening. A lot of people forget that if things are bottled in, it's difficult for people to even open up to us. So we provide a lot of non-judgmental atmosphere. Sometimes you can be on the hotline for 20 minutes and you as an advocate, you haven't really said anything. You're just listening. We try to normalize their feelings. We provide a lot of options as services that we have. We have counseling services, and we really stress on that because all our services are free and confidential. We highlight some of their strengths and some of the things that they've done to cope already. And we provide other options for them. And it's very individualized, Charlie. And I what we will tell one person will be so different from what we share with another individual, depending on their situation.
In the Sarah and Mark Mellor case, Sarah Mellor expressed remorse. She rode with her husband in the ambulance on the way to the hospital. She talked at sentencing about how much she loved him and excused his behavior and tried to portray herself not as a victim. How common is that, that response to a stressful environment?
It is it's a very normal dynamic in an abusive relationship or in a volatile type of relationship. And that is one of the reasons why we provide a lot of education about reasons why people stay in a relationship. And one of the reasons, and people find it really hard to believe or to even understand that a partner in a relationship, although they're the survivors or the victims, still care about their offender. That is a very normal dynamic in that relationship because, as I talked about earlier, there is this continuum, and abuse doesn't just happen as physical. There were good times. And so we look out for those good times, and we know and yearn for those. And so we hope that the person is going to change. It is very normal for a widow or a survivor who's lost the husband to still miss them and grieve. And it's very really hard for people to understand that.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Sena Ajabeng, who is the program coordinator for Countering Domestic Violence at Mid-Central Community Action and the Neville House program as well. How do they process that, though, and get some space to understand that, you know, this environment was not healthy and it was not good for me to be there?
How they process it takes a lot of counseling to do that. And I think that, you know, survivors sometimes get to a point where they're in denial. They minimize the abuse. They try to survive. That's why we talk about survival. And what seems very abnormal to us seems very normal to them because that's how the environment has become. And so going through counseling, and that's when a therapist or a counselor helps them process to get an understanding what the dynamics are, what the types of abuse.
Sarah Mellor had also been assaulted and beaten up a couple years ago in an apparently random act out in public, and had taken to carrying a knife after that incident, after she healed from that incident. Mm-hmm. And that ended up being the knife that she used to stab her husband. How much does prior stress or trauma affect a person's response in a volatile relationship moment?
In general, what we have noticed doing this work is that post-traumatic stress disorder is a very present when there's been past trauma. And having the opportunity to have resources and counseling is very important to be able to manage that stress or manage that trauma and have a normal, productive life. I'll give you an example. A few years ago, we had a client who had gone through therapy and counseling with us, but had experienced some prior trauma, and that was through her abusive relationship. One day she went to the store. She went to the grocery store, heard a specific music, and she froze in the store. Left everything and just walked out. There are others who are affected by smell. who are affected by a color. And sometimes, even if they've gone through all the healing, they have setbacks here and there. So it's very common to have those responses when you've had some trauma, either childhood trauma or some unfortunate trauma in your past. Yes.
Sarah Mellor was sentenced to 8 years in prison. She will likely serve at least 4 of those. Mm-hmm. We should not impugn the judge's decision or the advocates, either the state's attorney or the public defender, and how they conducted. But with that kind of result, does that send any particular message to other domestic violence sufferers in the community?
You know, this is a tough. It's a very tough situation when I think about it. And I thought about it when the case came to an end, and it really does not serve. You know, you have two families grieving, and it's a tough situation. It doesn't. I don't really think that. The message, whether it hurts or helps a victim, I think that we the way that we approach situations when we hear a victim talking about, I don't have a way out, or, you know, it's going to be me or them, we stress on having them take care of themselves, providing that support for them to get to a point to not feel like they don't have options, and to feel not to feel that they don't have a way out. And that's what we really stress on, because we still have loss, and we don't condone violence because that's what we do. So taking a life is taking a life, and it's just such an unfortunate situation, because we know that we have survivors who have to sort to that to defend themselves. That's a reality that some people will find themselves in that situation to defend themselves. So
does it inhibit a defense if they know that what happened to her, or does it inhibit them in an effort to get out?
I think that we hope that we're able to reach out to enough people to know that there's help out there, there's support out there, that if there's this an escalation of abuse, that we're hoping that we'll be able to be ones to provide that support and intervention, that they don't get to that point to resort to feeling that they don't have a choice.
Sheena Adjabang is the program director for Countering Domestic Violence and the Neville House Shelter. That's part of Mid-Central Community Action. She spoke with GLT's Charlie Schlenker. The 24-hour hotline for Countering Domestic Violence is 827-7070. You're listening to Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. It's been said millennials are the first true entrepreneur generation, and a pair of ambitious Twin Cities entrepreneurs are embracing that with a creation they dub Gag Practical that they're currently funding through a Kickstarter campaign. Laura Kennedy has more on this edition of the GLT Datebook.
Because everyone needs an anatomically significant sand timer for the procrastinator in their life, Adam Steffi and Elliot Wirth finally got off the pot and invented one. Dubbed the Toilet Timer, this sand timer is the focus of a Kickstarter campaign that is currently underway. Adam Steffi says the original inspiration for the Toilet Timer came from his wife.
Pointing out that sometimes when I go into the bathroom, I can get lost in a time trap, especially if I have my phone with me.
Oh, you take your phone into the bathroom.
I was reading these statistics from about 7 years ago, and it was about iPhones, and they said about 19% of people take their phone to the bathroom, and that was a number of years ago. I was like, it's probably 100% now.
It probably is.
Probably.
Right about now. So for finding yourself spending a lot of time in the loo, and you thought to yourself, I'm spending way too much time in the loo.
I mean, it can be a great escape. I also have three tiny kids in the house, and it can be a quiet spot as well. So it can also be a holy place. But we invented this little thing. It's fun. It's just it's a plastic sand timer. It's a different take on a traditional hourglass.
With a silhouette, it's all very strategic where the sand is coming out. We have a drawing of a guy in silhouette on his phone, on the loo, and the sand is coming out of a very specific anatomical place.
Oh, really? I thought that was an accident.
Elliot, did you design that?
No, that's all Adam.
Elliot, how did you get on board with this?
So I actually jumped on board the whole thing with Adam's previous venture, which is the one-up card for cleaning retro video games. I was actually taking a class at ISU that was all about timing and finding the best process for things. And he asked me to jump on board because he didn't have enough time with that. And when this came about, I joined him.
I started giving Elliot money to put product in packages for me,
yes.
Basically, efficiently.
Getting into the ground floor then.
Yes. Yeah, definitely.
And we're still, maybe we're underground now.
Yeah,
I don't know.
So. I don't know.
Well, you've got this toilet timer, and there's just a certain amount of sand in there that has to fall all the way through to the toilet at the bottom, and we can see the sand falling through. How did you decide how much sand there needed to be for the perfect amount of time one needs to spend on the toilet?
Lots of trial and error. So it's not even just the amount of sand. There's actually three things. There's the size of the hole that the sand is going through, the size of the sand that is going through the hole, and then the amount of sand. And so we actually got, I think it was like 10 different sizes of sand. Mm-hmm. And then so we had like 20 or 30 different toilet timers, 10 of each, one for each size of sand, and then different sizes of hole and different amounts, and timed all of them 5 minutes each and came out, figured out the one that was going to work best. And
that time is five minutes?
Yeah.
Okay, so 5 minutes is the ideal time that you need to be spending on the toilet.
Amen. We did some very intense market research and asked three friends, hey, 3 minutes, 5 minutes, or 7 minutes? And it came back, oh, five is good.
So what do you guys hope to accomplish with the toilet timer?
So for us, there's really nothing at risk with this project. We both have day jobs. We like doing our side business. We're trying to grow that. But this is just something that I like to say it was the culmination of my creativity and maturity to come up with a product like this. So we're putting it on Kickstarter, see what happens. Around Christmas of last year, Elliot took a whole lot of prototypes with him up to his work, and he would just spin them around and get the guy going. He would, mm-hmm. Load them up, and he would just put them on people's desks, and they would say, shut up and take my money.
So yeah. People were actually, Elliot at work, they were thinking, hey, this is cool. I need to get a toilet timer.
Yes.
But this is more than just maybe a gag gift.
We like to call it gag practical.
Gag practical? That's
yeah.
Great.
There's a slash in there somewhere.
Yeah.
But it also kind of serves a purpose because, I mean, here we have the idea of blank or get off the pot.
Yeah, I was wondering about the blank word.
But it's more than just a day-to-day kind of, I need to stop spending so much time in the bathroom kind of a thing. It's sort of a metaphor for what you guys have done, which is you've basically started yourselves and are being entrepreneurial.
That's exactly it. So I wasn't familiar with the phrase poop or get off the pot until into my 20s sometime. And I learned that and I had to ask the guy, I said, what does that even mean? And he described it. It's like, it's time to make a decision one way or the other, kind of quit waffling, take action, fish or cut bait is the other one. I couldn't quite turn that into a timer.
I'll bet you could figure it out.
So this project for us is it's about taking action. It's about doing something. We both kind of dreamed of doing a Kickstarter campaign sometime. And yeah, we do think it is kind of appropriate that this is a take action, let's move it, poop or get off the pot, time to go.
Explain to us, for people who have never been on Kickstarter or ever used it, how does Kickstarter work?
Basically, you have an idea, you have a set amount of money you want to raise, and people can come on board alongside you and give you a certain amount of money. The nice thing with Kickstarter is that you don't get that money until your funding is reached, so it's all or nothing. If not enough people back your project, then you get nothing. Their cards are never charged. But if you do fund or you go over your funding, then everyone's cards gets charged, you get the money, and then you get them the thing that you promised them.
And what you're promising them is their very own toilet timer?
Exactly. We've got different pledge levels that are set up for that, different package deals. Plan is to do the Kickstarter July 15 to August 15, and then upon successful funding, we'll have them produced. Our goal is to have them here for Christmas, into people's toilet bathrooms for Christmas.
Yes. So hang your stockings by the fire and hope that Santa will gift you with a toilet timer. I'm guessing you both are millennials.
Am I?
Are you?
So I'm 35, finally.
They keep saying I am, but I don't believe it.
So we don't know, Laura.
Let's just say younger people these days are far more entrepreneurial than in previous years. In fact, they're saying that the millennials are the first true entrepreneur generation. Hmm. They don't want to work for big corporations, although you guys do have day jobs. They want to be able to make their own way in the world. Do you say this is pretty much how you guys feel about things?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think one thing that Elliot and I are trying to do slowly and over time is build up a business that will provide for our families and that does provide certain freedoms in life that maybe you couldn't get with a corporate job. Of course, we're very thankful for the jobs we have and what it provides for us now. This is something that, like I said, is low risk, build it up over time, and maybe someday we get to take the full plunge.
What are your major selling points for the toilet timer, Adam?
On the Kickstarter, we're going to have some early bird specials. We actually have nicknamed the early turd specials.
Oh. Yes.
Early turd gets the worm. But so we're going to have a two-pack of these, one for you and one for a loved one. And you can get them at $12.50 each, so the package for $25. Mm-hmm. So there's a limited number of slots for doing that, so the early birds get that. But then it goes up to $15 each to get two of those.
And you have wall art, too.
So my dear sweet wife designed this nice little image of Toilet Timer Tommy.
Oh, he's got a name.
As we call him. Well, I guess her name's Toilet Timer Tina. And she's knocking on the door to try to get him to get a move on. And the wall art has it's the chocolate ice cream.
Uh-huh.
Emoji.
You mean like the emoji? Yeah.
With the eyes and the swirls.
Yeah, ice cream.
Brown guy.
That's.
And it says, do that or get off the pot. So.
We did a video.
Oh, cool.
So we have the video that's the commercial, and then we have the Meet the Creators video. The funny thing is, though, that, like, we did not prepare at all for the Meet the Creators video, and so, like, it was rough.
So I came up with the idea about a year and a half ago. I was doing a lot of 3D printing, came up with this little toilet timer guy, thought it was kind of funny, but really just put it on a shelf.
I was working with him at the time. I came in, I saw it on that shelf. I thought the poop humor was fantastically hilarious, and I told him we have to do something with this. We probably did like 10 takes of each thing, just like because we didn't even know what we were going to do.
Total so you amateurs. Just wanted to improvise your ways through
so
it.
So just like tonight, yeah.
And mm-hmm. That's fine. For works for me.
Yeah. What I did want to do is I wanted to, after every line that I said, I wanted to say, I'm Adam Steffi. Because what's the term for that?
The tag. Do you want to do an out cue there, Adam?
I do. I'm Adam Steffi.
Elliot.
I'm Elliot Worth.
And I'm Laura Kennedy.
Oh, man.
That was magical.
Yes.
Oh, man.
Adam Steffi and Elliot Worth are the creators of the Toilet Timer, which comes from their company, Katamco. They're aiming to raise $20,000 through their Kickstarter campaign, and as of today, they've nearly reached their August 14th goal with just over $19,000 raised. You're listening to Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The indie rock band Dawes plays the Castle Theater in Bloomington July 31st. Occasional GLT music critic Taylor Bauer considers the California-born and bred quartet to be one of the most exciting bands of the past 5 years. He sat down with GLT's John Norton for an edition of What's on Your Turntable to play songs from and talk about Dawes' latest album, We're All Gonna Die.
Yeah, so 3 years ago, Dawes played a show 15 minutes from my house, and this is up, you know, in Aurora, Illinois, and I didn't get a chance to see them. And then, like, I randomly got an email from the Castle Theater that was like, show's coming near you, and like, I've been really loving the lineups they've had. And I saw Dawes, and I was like, there's no way. I was like, that's awesome. Like, I can finally check that off of my list of regrets.
So on GLT, we ask people what is on their turntable. Every time we talk to one of the record store owners in town, and every once in a while someone hits us up, and Taylor sent us an email saying, Dawes is coming. I want to talk about Dawes because I've been playing nothing but Dawes. But 3 years ago, they had a little bit of a different sound, didn't they?
A very different sound. And I'll be the first to admit that the first spin that I bought this record, I'm not going to not buy a Dawes album.
So what song are we listening to right now?
This is the lead track on the album, We're All Gonna Die. It's called One of Us. If you heard this song, you're not thinking Dawes of, 2011, 2013. They kind of made a name for themselves as indie rock revival, which is a huge thing now. And it's so broad, but they always kind of put a little bit of a Tom Petty twist on it, a little twangy, a little bit southern rock, a little bit just something to draw them out from the rest of the crowd. And they kind of seemed on this album to go back to things that everyone's doing. It's like they made a name for themselves with this unique sound, and now they're kind of playing catch up with how indie rock is changing with synthesizers, trying to sound a little bit more pop friendly, but it's still the same band. And the thing that hasn't gone away, which I'm very thankful for, are the amazing harmonies that they can put out. Everyone in this band sings. And if it wasn't for Taylor Goldsmith, their lead singer, I'm pretty sure the rest of the members could be a lead singer in some other band. About the secret dreams of learning how to dance. Hear four-part harmonies in an otherwise pop-ish sounding indie rock record, it kind of takes you by surprise. And I think people who haven't listened to Dawes before, who might hear, basic four chords, tambourine, just very commonly structured indie rock songs, are going to be surprised when they dig into the lyrics, listen to the vocals, and realize how talented these musicians are.
Dawes has been described as a band with that Laurel Canyon sound, which is a reference back to the late 1960s from, Joni Mitchell and maybe Jackson Browne and a lot of those folks. Does it really apply?
Yeah, absolutely.
No. Crosby, Stills, and Nash, maybe another one?
That's the one I was about to say. Yeah, I think, Neil Young is probably the closest that I would say in terms of sound. And then also, this immeasurable, vibe they have. You kind of get the feeling that this is music you're going to be listening to on a road trip, where you're going to be connected to something other than yourself. And it's not going to be your cell phone, right? You're going to be listening to this when you're, out doing something outside. Or, staying active. It just makes you want to, go out and see the world. It kind of gives you a soundtrack for, all these experiences that you want to have, but, other things get in the way. Your job, you're on Facebook 9 hours a day, something like that. This music, I feel like, inspires you the same way Neil Young kind of always did, where it's like, no, I want to get out and see the world. I need to know your secret. I'm asking you for help. How do I fall in love with anything like you seem to do so well? We're All Gonna Die is the name of the album. It's Dawes. We are at the Castle Theater here July 31st. Taylor Bauer is taking us through this album. What song do you want to go to next? So the lead track on the album was called When the Tequila Runs Out. And this was the first song I heard on the album when they were starting to do promotions for it. This is the one that kind of made me take a step back and think, this isn't Dawes anymore. It's very upbeat, and they've always been a little melancholy, but then when you really hear what they're singing about, it's about the same themes of, togetherness, coming together with your friends, your family, and while in the past they've sang about, hard times bringing people together, this time it's tequila. There were a lot of leather jackets, there was a haircut reading palms. There was a line outside the bathroom that didn't really move. When the tequila was out, we'll be drinking champagne. When the tequila was out. I take it the change of music has brought their fans along with them as well? Yeah, I mean, everyone I know, and just, from what, how the album did when it came out, has, been very positive about it. You never want to be the artist that does the same album five times or even three times. And I think what they were running into is their first couple albums, you know, all the way starting back in 09, were very similar. And it was good, but you kind of get to a point where, you know, I'm guessing the artists didn't want to be that band that just sounded that one way. And I think that, you know, a huge part of that is the lead singer and who does most of the vocals. His name's Taylor Goldsmith. The way he uses words feels very much like Paul Simon almost, where you don't feel like he's trying to get all, you know, broad, or he's trying to like make some general like comment about the world. Like, no, he's going to be specific. He's going to talk about himself, first person, you know, I, me, and it's going to feel like he's telling you a story. I'm always weary at people who are really focused on doing like, you know, things about them, because then it can be harder for like listeners to like relate to it. But the way he does it, you just kind of hear it in his voice, and like you can read it in his lyrics, that he's gone through some things that like are universal to like the human experience. And he does a really good job of putting it into words where I think a lot of people might struggle with.
All right, one more song, Taylor Bauer, from the Dawes album, We're All Going to Die.
So as if the name of the album wasn't uplifting enough, the last track is called Quitter. Kind of sounds like a negative, but this is like an upbeat, kind of like low-key funk sound that I didn't really know that they could do. And I think this is a perfect example of how the album surprised me, and I'm sure surprised other fans, that there are so many different sounds going on and so many different influences that you don't really know what to call them, especially on an album like this where they've kind of rewrote their like genre and their sound. They're all of a sudden kind of taking, you know, their music back and saying, you know, it's not this, it's not indie rock, it's not, you know, Southern rock revival, it's going to be like us. It's not all over the place. It's very direct in its way of saying like, this is what we want to talk about, but like this music is supposed to kind of give you the energy to like think about it and know that you can be honest with yourself and not get down. And I feel like that contrast between like darker lyrics and more upbeat instrumentals is a nice way of saying like, you know, if you're not where you want to be in life right now, you have the power to change that. And you can do it without having to sacrifice like what you truly think of yourself.
Occasional GLT music critic Taylor Bauer talking with GLT's John Norton about the most recent Dawes album, We're All Gonna Die. For an edition of What's on Your Turntable, Dawes plays the Castle Theater July 31st. What's on your turntable? Let us know by visiting WGLT.org. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. At our website, find the full show podcast and the individual stories and interviews heard today. Thanks to Charlie Schlenker, Laura Kennedy, and John Norton. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Email us at news@WGLT.org, post a comment at facebook.com/WGLTFM, or tweet about the show. Use the hashtag Sound Ideas. I'm at Mike McCurdy. We're all at WGLT News. Choosing GLT 89.1 FM, Bloomington Normal's public media.